We're recording on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people, and we acknowledge them as traditional owners. We'd also like to pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land.
Midnight to midnight. Welcome. Screening. Welcome to midnight screening. Welcome to screening. Welcome to midnight screening. I am screaming. I am screaming.
I am screaming.
Welcome to Midnight Screening, where we let you stay up past your bedtime with the movies you probably shouldn't be watching. I'm Noah Jansen, here with Eliza. How are you going, Eliza?
Hey, good. How are you doing?
I'm good. And Anthony, still back, getting used to you being back in the space.
Yeah, very much.
It's very much that object in permanent. What's that called? Object in permanent.
What, like a baby where you forget Anthony exists?
Yeah, like if you shaved your beard, I'd like cry or something.
There's a stranger in my house.
What are you doing?
Do you feel betrayed or jealous at all that we had Brandon do those few episodes?
If anything, I felt like worried that I would feel like a bit inferior or something, because Brandon has like a legit I was gonna say background, but that's the wrong word because it's current like work in the like dialogue industry in particular. But I listened back to stuff that I had recorded with you before that, and I thought that they sounded good and fine, so I'm not too stressed about it. But
we love you both equally.
No, I'm just glad that you got like
the goods.
Yeah, I'm glad it still worked. I'm glad there was no break in the schedule.
It did. Exactly.
It takes a village sometimes.
Exactly. And we've really like, what number was this? Is this 12? We were saying we're really on the way now.
It is not. This is number 13. Unlucky.
Choo-choo.
I remember this last time, last podcast we did, where we were like, we've done this a lot.
Coming through. Yeah.
I also think last time we took more breaks because we weren't taking it as seriously.
And also COVID.
That all just
did quite a bit of stuff during COVID, but very far apart.
I did not like COVID. I don't know about you guys, but I thought it was a bit annoying.
It was a bit awkward.
Yeah, that awkward moment when everyone got COVID.
And had to stay inside. Very rufflecopter point of time. Very, very much so. Thank you, everyone, for coming back for another episode. We had a really good time last week on our very first iteration.
Schlop bucket.
Of the schlop bucket, which is where we give our patrons a poll where they can pick whatever cinematic punishment they want to subject us to. So we gave you some options and you got to pick the horrible piece of shit films we had to watch.
It's like those fairground things that I've only ever seen in media where you throw the ball and someone falls in the bucket if they throw the ball right on the target. And you're like going to regularly do that.
Yeah. Frequently. I pitch it as like a piece of punishment. And as we talked about last week, it's kind of like Eliza essentially sleeps in a bed of the slop because
I was born in the slop bucket.
Adopted it.
Yeah,
it's your like special interest is these piece of shit films, but neither of us had seen what we watched last week, so we
jump on the Patreon and listen because it was a good discussion, faith-based filmmaking.
If you hate films but you love discussions of theology and religion, this is the episode for you.
Is it?
Yeah, exactly.
And no.
But we talked about, you all picked for us to watch evangelical Christian rapture horror movie PSAs with a sick theme song. And those films were A Thief in the Night and Left Behind. We watched those. We did not like them. And now, as of this episode being out, there is a new poll up. So the two things that like didn't win the poll last time,
they're continuing through. We will have to watch them at some point, and we've added a nice tasty new option.
And we've added a new friend for you. So here's what we've got on the new poll now. So if you have a very strong opinion about these, you know what you have to do. Head to the Patreon to vote. Pick your poison. The three options are a no-budget Canadian DTV horror film shot on Super 8. The magnum opus of an oil billionaire's grandson that was in production for 15 years. And our new friend joining the party, a former architect, writes, directs, edits, caters, and stars in a conspiracy thriller as a hacker who causes government leaders to commit suicide en masse.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a big, bold entry. Again, I'm letting Eliza sort of champion us forward with these. I'm prepared for any of them. But nice. That's not what we're doing today. Today we're doing something I'm really excited for. I think it's kind of why we invented this for invented, why we like doing this format of the Midnight Marathon, where we sort of dive into a filmmaker or a topic or a series,
our
whatever it is.
Our first Midnight Marathon was based in genre, trying to learn more about the slasher, and with the legendary Pope of pop cinema, Roger Corman, passing away recently. It felt like the right time to focus on his filmography.
Exactly.
He's obviously a massive producer, tastemaker, started the careers of so many really important figures in Hollywood film and in, like, international film. Like, we don't have Ingmar Bergman or Kurosawa. Like, we don't have their
without
American impact
American
without
distribution.
Him getting the distribution sorted out. But we're just going to look into his directing, like the films that he's credited as director on.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing where, like, obviously this format is always just giving a bit of like a tasting platter of these things. Yeah. And especially with Roger Corman, like, you would be very hard pressed to find an American like film artist with as far a reach as Roger Corman. He passed away at the age of 98, extremely iconic for independent filmmaking, for genre filmmaking. He was, the spiritual godfather of the new Hollywood, king of cult. As Liz said, like, I think he would maybe be most famous as like a producer that gave us filmmakers like Francis Ford Coppola, like James Cameron. And for today, I thought it would be good. Yeah, for this series, we thought it'd be good to just focus on like his directorial works. And with the films we've picked, they've kind of like shown lots of interesting sides of his like ethos already in the films themselves. Even though they're not ones he's produced, they all really reflect his attitude towards filmmaking, which the resounding thing you'll hear is like, essentially, no matter what, no matter what's happened, no matter how much money you have, always be filming. Like, no matter what it is, you get the days filming.
He's like insanely prolific and was producing other people's stuff on the side. Like I said, that he has almost like 400 produced films, and then he is credited as director for like about 60.
And it's just, absolutely. And the whole brand is this idea of just like making something on the cheap isn't making something without love.
Mm.
And it's this idea of like, yeah, like we had it with our film last year where we were kind of rescheduling, and I very much had the thought very consistently that like an attitude that does not get you through the process of the like fucking ridiculously hard task of making a movie is this very pure regard for like it all needs to be completely perfect. Like, very few filmmakers speak about any of their films as being like every single shot is exactly what I wanted. It's a business where it's a medium where you're always balancing art and commerce. And Roger Corman was like a god of that. Like, his whole career was just being like, just because we're shooting it in 2 weeks for like $100,000 doesn't mean, and just because like you can see some of the edges sometimes doesn't mean there aren't other aspects where we are miles ahead of the game because it's made with passion and cheek and charm.
Yeah, I have been stunned in watching these movies. I was expecting, like, you know, we just talk about schlop bucket. I love schlop. I love trash.
Yeah.
They don't have a trashy feel to them at all. Like, I've been consistently surprised how sophisticated each of these movies are.
I completely agree. I actually think that, again, like I hadn't seen it before, but the first film we're going to talk about today not only is an amazing film, but sort of feels like a very personal statement about art.
Yeah.
For him. So I feel like we should jump into our first film.
Today
the two films we're talking about today are A Bucket of Blood and
Look at the Blood.
Look at the Blood. And The Intruder, which are two early films of his that speak.
Not the earliest, but
yes, exactly.
Two ones that we wanted to watch from his early years.
And I don't think we've mentioned, like, when I like when you say Roger Corman, I think of like B movie, like monsters,
sci-fi, motorbikes,
like very handmade pulpy props, motorbikes, like, you know, like Bikini Beach movies, like all those things we associate with like the drive-in and the spirit of movies like that is Roger Corman. So there's throughout these six episodes, we are, although they're all very much based in genre.
Three episodes? Six movies?
Yeah, yeah. Six movies, three episodes. Yep. Did I say that?
You said six episodes.
Oh, yeah. Not six episodes. We ain't doing that.
It's not a double marathon.
A quadruple marathon, no. Six movies. We will get such a wide breadth of styles and stuff. We're going to be in little intimate claustrophobic rooms. We're going to be on the highway. We're going to be tripping out on drugs.
Yay! And also great. We're going to watch some movies.
Indeed.
Before we jump in, a fun thing that I only recently learned about Roger Corman is that he's the reason that the Fast and Furious movies have those stupid names for their sequels.
What? What do you mean?
Yeah. So the like 2000s car movies, Fast and Furious, they got their title from one of the very first movies that Roger Corman directed called The Fast and Furious, or he wrote the story for it. And they got the rights to use that name. And then they wanted to just keep going Fast and Furious 2, Fast and Furious 3. And Corman did not allow that. So that's why they had to be called Too Fast, Too Furious.
That is
whatever, whatever.
So funny.
So that's a nice little gift from Roger Corman.
Tokyo Drift.
Yeah.
The first episode of Twin Peaks.
Oh, wow. Ages and ages.
See, Roger Corman even in another lifetime.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have Teriyaki Boys Tokyo Drift without Roger Corman.
No.
That is one of the very
strange audio stuff that I did on those opening episodes.
I have to listen back. I'm sure you rocked them. Yeah. I can't walk around a corner without saying Tokyo Drift. So look at what he's done. Yeah. I think with Corman, like, you know, as with any life, like part of the charm as well is that like, there would be filmmakers who would say that he was efficient, and there would be filmmakers that would say he was cheap. Like there are many, many stories of people being like, he
reused footage from this one and that one.
I don't know enough about it, but like, I believe he wasn't on great terms with some of his relatives because like he was cutting them out of the estate and stuff. Like cheap very bastard. Defining characteristic of him is his regard to money, which is very iconic.
He's on
in
that
regards to filmmaking
mindset and you know,
that's it. You got to be to make films like these. Hey, let's jump into A Bucket of Blood.
Whee! Splash. Woo-hoo!
Splash. Kaplonk. A little story to open with that really encapsulates the filmmaking mentality that leads to such brilliant films as this in their economic use of money and the charm that comes out of
economic
that.
Use of money.
The economic the efficient.
Yeah.
I don't know. Should get better at words. If you're going to have a podcast, I say I do be rambling. Is this really great jewel? This is a story from Ron Howard, who is one of the many, many, many people that got their start in a directorial sense from your boy Roger Corman. So in 1977, Ron Howard gets his directorial debut with the film Grand Theft Auto, which is produced by Corman. It had a $600,000 budget. He agreed to like a classic Corman deal where Roger Corman wanted Ron Howard to star in one of his upcoming films, a like Girls on Hot Rods film called Eat My Dust.
Oh, that's and awesome.
Very cool. And he said he would do it on the basis that he would be allowed to direct Grand Theft Auto. He rocks up on set, or like it's a day on set. Corman comes to set and sees that Ron Howard is like stressed out of his mind because it's a huge crowd scene and there are like no extras. There's not really enough extras for it at all. And he's convincing this classic B-movie producer to like pay for more extras. He's begging him for more. And Roger Corman puts his hand on a young Ron Howard's shoulder, smiled and said, "Ron, I'm not going to give you more extras, but know this, if you do a good job for me on this picture, you'll never have to work for me again." Which is just the spirit of being like, I know that this, that the terms of this is not the dream that anyone has for making a film, but at the end of it, you will have directed a film. Like, damn. I love that. I mean, that's so charming.
Damn.
And A Bucket of Blood is, to me, relatively uninitiated on. I've seen more things he's produced than directed, but what an incredible case of like a lot of choices being made out of necessity, but making a great film. This film, A Bucket of Blood, was produced on a $50,000 budget. It was shot in 5 days, and the entire set is a thing that he did a lot. Was it's a completely repurposed set from a film that is very tonally similar and deals with very similar ideas, which is Little Shop of Horrors.
Wait, no, Little Shop of Horrors came out the next year. Did they reuse?
They used this. This set is a completely repurposed set.
That's for so
Little
funny.
Shop of Horrors. Because Little Shop of Horrors was shot in 2 days. I think it has a record for the. I'll double check that, but it is some sort of record.
Damn.
And it's funny because they're both films that deal with the idea of.
They're very similar movies.
Really similar films. So this film, A Bucket of Blood, is about. It's a very sort. So the lead character is played by the brilliant Dick Miller.
I've never seen him in a lead role before.
Neither.
It was a real pleasure.
It was such a good role for him. You'll recognize
this guy. He's like the grouchy old neighbor in Gremlins. He's in every Joe Dante movie. Joe Dante being another acolyte of the Roger Corman school or whatever.
Absolutely. And like, yeah, very much someone but that you always see in secondary like, roles.
Yeah, a little geeky loser main character.
Was like, so great. Oh exactly.
There you go, buddy.
So he plays a very impressionable, sort of like dumb, very sweet, shy busboy called Walter Paisley, who works at like a beatnik artist.
Cool, like Greenwich Village kind of bohemian cafe.
Essentially, he works with all these like pretentious, like he is the waiter for a bunch of like pretentious, snobby artists. And he wishes he could be a true artist, but he himself, he tries to put clay together to make something beautiful and it doesn't work out until one night when he accidentally stabs his neighbor's cat in the wall and then gets the bold idea to use the cat as the mold and inspiration for a piece. So he puts clay over the cat, calls it Dead Cat, and it's a classic be careful what you wish for scenario where he becomes this extremely revered artist off the back of the only cost to his artistic validation being murder and blood.
He has to keep killing people.
And covering them in clay.
He couldn't like cover like a plant or like a freaking bottle of water in clay. It has to be a living form.
Also like you could just go like get the doll of those things and cover it in clay as well. But again, the charm of it being like, it is this sort of horror comedy tone that, it strikes really well. The whole scenario is really funny. And again,
it's a really fun environment to be in. Like the bohemian 50s.
It's so funny.
Your dig daddy, yo. Ooh, have cat, you bat, you better wet.
Like these guys, there's these like fake poet dudes that are so pretentious.
Yeah, and again, bloviating asshole poet Maxwell, who sucks.
Had you seen this movie before?
I hadn't, but it was really funny watching after Little Shop of Horrors. The only Corman I've really seen was Death Race 2000, which is awesome, and Little Shop of Horrors. And they are sort of ridiculously similar. They're both black and white, like you said, both same set. And they're both about a nerdy sort of underling who realizes he has to kill in order to professionally succeed and have people, you know, give him attention and love.
This idea of like the almost the shy goodness of you being the weakness holding you back from success that also like helps you get the girl. And
there's
like
a lot of similar things like, there's the love interest, the girl, this really glamorous girl that they lust after, like a really cheap, like Jewish coded boss or, you know, manager or something who you're Mr. Mushnik, who loves the our main character once they start earning the money and acclaim and stuff, and like annoying old landlord or grandma kind of character. Like
having seen both,
they're really just reskinned kind of versions of each other.
Exactly. Yeah. But again, like that's part of like what is so charming is to know to like reuse a set mm-hmm. and get a whole film out of it in a few days. What was the secret weapon of this film to me that made it such a good, like we have this lots where like we'll pick something that we want to try out and then be like, how is this such a great fit for what we want to do in this Midnight Marathon? That what I liked most about it was its critique in this sort of like heightened satire way of an extremely pretentious regard for art. Like mm. this Dick Miller character really is a like cipher for Roger Corman. This idea of like existing in a space where there are all these artists that have a very high opinion of themselves, that believe their art, like they all talk explicitly like my art is what changes the world, mm. is what pushes the needle forward.
And everyone else is in brainless normie shape.
Yeah.
One of my favorite lines was when the love interest girl just says, "Oh, I'm so glad I'm aware." Yeah. It's like, that's the least aware thing you could say. Like,
exactly. Like they're all, like they are all morons yeah. that he sees as like so intelligent. But that class, it's like Corman. Like that's his whole career is being like,
yeah,
and I also, get it made. Like I just make a thing that like services, you know, we've talked to mm-hmm. like we watch horror films, we talk about being like, if slop is well made, like something existing for the function of entertaining people or being fun,
it can really transcend the sum of its parts.
Is so much definitely. More charming and mature to have like such a sense of humor about yourself. And yeah. I just think it's so funny that like he essentially made a film that is about him being like, at least I fucking get them done. At least yeah. they're funny. At least they entertain people. They may not like win an Oscar or, yeah, you know, get he'd already the Orson Welles tick of approval or whatever.
This came out in 1959. He'd been making films for the 4 years before and he'd already made like 15 movies or so. Like
yeah.
insanely prolific. And you can see it as him perhaps being a bit defensive and being
so.
Like, well, look at yourselves. Like you guys are all jerking each other off over your coffees and like alfalfa sprout brownie. Like I'm doing the work. I'm out here serving you.
Yeah. And it feels like just distinct enough as well to be like, you wouldn't know. Well, firstly, to be like, yeah, you think it makes you intelligent that you actually think your art changes the world. Whereas mm. at least I'm aware that what we are doing is mostly indulgent.
To and impress for, each other. I just want to get the girl. I just want you guys to pat circle. Me on the back.
It's about getting each other's approval.
Yeah.
And also the basis of being like, this work of mine that you loved was like built on a bucket of blood. Like it's built negatively. On just like
yeah.
murder. And
I think it's also yeah, that depravity. Like Walter's art, like you only have one scene of him trying to do art in the proper way. Like he's yeah. trying to, and he's trying to copy a picture of a face of the girl that he likes and he sucks at it. And then the rest of his art is killing an undercover cop, killing this like skanky woman who was kind of rude to him and covering them in clay. So his art is always just mimicry or like yeah. covering over an existing thing. And I feel like Corman would be able to relate to that a lot as well of like
the reskinning.
Sweet, let's do another movie about evil crabs. Huh? Yeah. This movie about like, you know, a killer carded. Well, I'm going to make one too. And it's
totally.
Like, I don't know, is imitation flattery? Does it kind of have value in itself? Like,
it just felt like a sense of humor that he slipped into so easily that I was like, this feels so personal to you. Like yeah. it was so charming to, yeah, every version of it making fun of like a pretentious art scene was like, this plays today. Like this is like yeah. living in Brunswick.
I think also like we can really hate it when a movie is about great art. Like yeah. when characters are jerking off one guy and being like, your novel changed my life. Or like, wow, this song is so good. You always talk about in Rent, the final song where it's like, this song will change the world or whatever. And you're like, this song sucks. And it sucks especially because the story in like canonically, this is meant to be the best song ever. And I didn't think about that in this movie. Like the sculptures he makes are pretty striking and cool looking, like they're well done props.
And they have like a cool macabre expression on them. That
yeah,
like,
people are really scared when they see his horrible ones. They're yeah. really turned on when they see his like female nude sculpture yeah. or whatever.
The one I liked about that one is this idea of like him, I guess it's like, you know, he makes films that get in and get out, which I appreciate. But like that kill has that interesting idea of him having to like pose someone before he kills them, which I like.
Yeah, that's
because
funny.
Essentially he's told like you know, you need to make something that's more about, like, there's too much depravity. Like, you need to make something about sensitivity. So it's him trying to, like, get this woman to pose in a certain position before he kills her so that it looks not like someone's, like, being captured in their final moment. An idea that I thought could have resonated if it happened again at the very end. Did you like the very end?
Where... Walter hangs himself.
Yeah, Walter hangs himself, and it's supposed to be this final reveal that it's like his greatest piece ever, and he's like covered in clay. But like,
he didn't look that covered, really. It's like, how would you do that?
They went with logic of being like, how would someone cover themselves in clay? And I'm like, it's just like a dumb.
Like, I wanted just to make see a it, big block sculpture swinging from
exactly.
the beam.
I wanted to see him literally as like a giant clay man swinging.
You've got like
from the ceiling
liquid-ish clay in like a vat. Underneath you,
exactly,
and you are like above the clay at first, but when you jump off to hang yourself, your body lands in the clay.
So yeah, and then when they pull up the rope, you come out as this amazing sculpture.
I'm pretty sure they probably had like 30 minutes left to go before they had to wrap, so that's probably
get
why.
Get that clay on your face right now! Action!
Yeah, I did think that the final beats were.
Did you like all the dead people in the sculptures being like? Oh, you killed us.
Yeah, that was
great.
And
then you hear the cat go, meow.
Yeah, there were good cat beats.
I have to say,
I loved it as a It's Always Sunny fan. This film truly starts with a cat in the wall, eh? Like his cat is fully in the wall. And that
I
was
have to say,
to
if Pearl dies.
She will never die.
No, I don't want to think about it. But maybe I'd have a taxidermy covering her ears or covered in clay or something. How nice would it be to have a clay pearl just sitting there that you can look at?
Oh, I would hate that so much, Eliza. Eliza,
what if it was heated
one day
and you just had it on the couch? And then
so Eliza has, have you actually like gone to the classes about being a mortician?
I haven't been to any classes. I've been to like death cafes.
Yeah. So Eliza loves taxidermy and it's about being a
mortician.
I wouldn't say I've studied it. I've dabbled.
I mean, it gets really smelly, so you gotta like leave it.
I don't taxidermy. I don't know if I even like taxidermy. But yeah, it interests me, the preserving bodies or whatever.
I think it reads for you. Just don't do it while we live together.
Okay.
And don't do it to Pearl. Leave her.
I don't want to do anything to Pearl, but
you'd want to put her in clay.
I guess we have our other pets as like just ashes, which is nice because it's sort of like a little receptacle and you're like, oh, I feel like their spirit is in there or something. But for Pearl, like it would just break my heart. Like maybe I just get like a pillow that looks like her and have her on the couch.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we should
do. Are you compromise with that?
Yeah, I would want a little memorial one. I actually think about, unfortunately, Pearl's death all the time.
Don't.
I'm so scared of it. Like I'll have to take the week off. It'll be hell.
She's so dumb. She doesn't even know we're talking about it right now. She's so
she's
content.
Just hanging out. Because that's why she's so cool. She doesn't give a shit. Other beats of this film I wanted to flag that I love. Just like it is very funny and Dick Miller is really funny. There's one scene that I love where essentially, so he has like.
He really becomes an asshole.
He really goes there.
Like beyond the murder, he just becomes like an annoying, entitled little prick.
I think the end kind of like. It just finishes, but there is more of a resolve. I do like the idea that like it's not the redemption arc really. He kind of just like goes into the pits and then dies. But I really like this beat in the middle where he has like a new fan because of his work. And she's like, I don't have money to give you, but here's this. And she gives him a bag and he doesn't know what it is, but it's like heroin. And an undercover cop follows him home. And it's just the very funny scene of like you know, like someone that literally has no idea.
He's like comically naive. Like
he's like fully like baby boy. He's like so
little nerd.
So sweet, like fresh sunflower little boy.
He's and like, do you know what that is? And he's like, I don't know.
He's like, what's this? I don't know what that is. And he's like, that's horse. And he's like, oh, well, wasn't that nice of Naeolia to give me that expensive horse? He's like, that's probably really expensive. And he's like, oh, that's so nice of her. Like as you're like about to be arrested. It's very funny.
It was good.
And one more thing I did think towards the end was like the whole film had set up this idea of him always being like, is that he says like, don't turn the heater on or do turn the heater on. Essentially he needs it. I think it's that he needs it to be cold because otherwise the clay will melt.
Slip and stuff. Yeah.
And I thought the film was setting us up for, it has a gallery showing at the end and he leaves
and
the gallery
melts.
And that because there's, you see one of the patrons like start to, pick at one of the
boss at the cafe who first sort of takes advantage of him and is like, yeah, I'll let you display your art. And it massively takes off. He scratches away a bit of the clay
and he sees like a thing.
Fur or skin or something underneath.
Yeah, so like it is discovered by picking through the clay, but I thought it should have been like the mass thing all at once of the clay melting and everyone being like, oh my God. I thought it should have done that, but that's fine. Again,
and that would have been a really cool art display as well. Like that could have been what the asshole Maxwell poet guy is like, this is his greatest work of art, like revealing the bodies underneath, how morbid, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Damn.
Yeah.
Wish you could go back in time to 1959.
And tell him in whatever those 5 days were.
He could have ended up being Coppola or James Cameron. Or
truly. Isn't that so funny? You ever think about like a work week? Imagine if you made a film in a work week. Incredible. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved A Bucket of Blood. It was
I liked it more than Little Shop of Horrors. I think Little Shop of Horrors kind of snappier dialogue.
Because I love the musical of Little Shop of Horrors. Yeah. But it made, like I'd always thought I would watch the film. But to be honest, as like once I was 10 minutes into A Bucket of Blood, I already was like, I know I've how plot-wise similar this is to Little Shop of Horrors, but it has the added element of this sort of meta self-critique with this whole art scene that makes me be like, it'll probably be a long time before I watch
it. Felt Little really Shop fresh now. And particular to the scene. Like even if it's, you know, LA filmmakers sort of mocking the really urbane, cosmopolitan Greenwich Village kind of Brooklynite art wankiness. Like, yeah, it was a really funny, engaging portrait of all of that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I really liked it. Not that I didn't think I would, but I liked it much more than I thought I would. I was like, I was like, this is going to be a really fun series. Yeah.
A bucket of blood.
Bucket of blood. Let's check out The Intruder.
Thanks very much, Mr. Clark.
Aren't you two forgetting something?
How about channel 27?
Blood pressure of 160 over 80. Heart rate of 88. Normal sinus at this time.
Everything is going to be all right. You have only to stay inside. You only have to stay all right. Do not look outside. Do not look outside. Do not need to look outside. Look out, look out, look out, look out, look out.
Nice. When you watched this film, The Intruder from 1962, what title did it have on the video you watched?
Yeah, I know, right? It said, I hate your guts.
That was hard as hell. To start the movie, William Shatner is smugly riding on a bus, black and white movie, and in white text it comes up and says, I hate your guts. I was like, this rocks.
It's so good. And like, just so everyone knows, like, you know, now if you try, it's called The Intruder by all. It's just one of those films with an
It's also been called title. Shame and The Stranger. And I don't know which, I think I Hate Your Guts is the best.
I don't think it's maybe a little pulpy. I think
for what's actually quite a very stern,
I think what's
social
interesting,
realist drama film.
Exactly. I Hate Your Guts is a Corman title, but what's interesting about this film is that it's the very rare case, as he's spoken about in his filmography, of being like, it's not really allegory. It's a very literal text. Like it deals with this. I did not expect it to just be.
I was completely caught off guard by it. It's not what I thought it would be at all.
A very like literal, very dramatic, depressing portrait of like extreme racial like conflict in America in the like mid, what is it? The Midwest. Like it's fully just about
it's
school
down
segregation.
Cause they have those crazy accents.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. What's it about?
So the movie, I gotta be real. I did not know anything about this going in.
Neither.
And I thought it was going to be that William Shatner's character, the intruder, the stranger, was like an alien or some shit like that.
I thought it would be like a sort of like a claustrophobic between two apartments, sort of like a nosy neighbor kind of like becomes a killer or something. But it's not that.
It's William Shatner rolls into town, into this really small southern town where the one high school in town has just become desegregated and 7 black students are about to start class there. And he starts kind of taking the temperature of the motel owner, where he's staying, neighbors in other rooms, folks around town, and they drop the N-word like it's gone out of fashion. And boy, is it. It is pretty brutal to hear the way people talk about these like 7 black teens who are going to their kids' school. And there is one other man in town who runs the newspaper who he's still racist. There is no character in the entire film who is not racist.
His redemption arc is, to be clear, like the film is very, very much critiquing this community, but is very much about like people who have never been able to confront the like racial divide of America being met with the fact that like it has arrived. The thing that is repeated all throughout the film is white bigots being like, of course I don't agree with it, but what are you going to do? It's what, it's the law. Like it's
like ultimately it's the heroes are kind of people who aren't like, it's fine, let these kids go to my kid's school.
They don't really agree with it.
Come on, we have to follow the rules.
It's about the rules. Yeah, exactly.
And so William Shatner, he's this like outside force. Oh my God, I can see the cat. The rival cat is outside.
We have a rival street cat.
The intruder. The intruder. No, please don't start a race riot. Rival cat. He's like an outsider who, everyone there is plenty racist, but because he's a newcomer, he's a really great public speaker. He does a lot of hand gestures and rolls up his sleeves in a way that reminds you of Adolf Hitler.
It's him going full like preacher.
He foments hatred in this novel and new way to them. And Shatner is really charismatic.
Such a good, probably like the best act. I guess I've only really seen him in Star Trek and stuff, but like incredible performance. Like you'd have to really, just that thing where you're like to sell the conviction of someone like this is being like, I channel my charisma and charm.
My charisma, uniqueness, nerve and talent, mama.
And my sleaze, all of the above. I channel it into this would be a really unfortunate acting challenge on RuPaul is to make people be this bigoted, like hate preacher in the South.
The intruder. That's what we would call it. Talk about this again. What did you say, Anthony?
They would do that.
No, that's like what America's Next Top Model would have done like 10 years ago. And it's, again, like it's just, it's not allegory. It's, I guess the way that it is allegory, like what to
it's
me,
also based on a novel from the 50s, we should point out.
Yeah, absolutely. And it didn't do very well. It's like really well regarded. Like it has a lot of reappraisal and people really enjoy it. I think Corman speaks highly of it still. He just does say after this film, I made the choice that like people engage with these ideas more when it's subtext or when it's like not the main driving force of the story, which is obviously like to a degree, we should be able to talk about these, like the literal facts of how these things happen need to be talked about. But I do also think, especially like inside of genre, that's what genre cinema is good at doing. But it doesn't really play into my enjoyment of this film because the subtext that is really clever to me in this is this idea. It's a lot of what we talked about last week with this sort of very Christian, like evangelical Christian mentality towards just coexisting with people, which is to say the person that like smiles at you behind like gritted teeth that's actually like trying to manipulate you is for some reason socially regarded more than the person that in front of your face is like, I'm fighting for my life, I'm not safe. And when there's a really good early moment where we finally cut to the black community in their part of town and you just like in their house and you just feel the presence of like, all I've seen is people walking around in sparkling white suits and like turning on the charm and supposedly being nice, but like being extremely misogynistic, being very controlling.
That's
being very,
a really like accurate part to it that Adam's hatred, it's not just racist. It's like he also draws in like anti-Semitism and part of it that I found sort of like winking and clever or whatever is like when he's in town, a lot of the like stuff that he gets in trouble for, a lot of the, you know, the troublemaking that he does, it follows a lot of the stereotypical paranoias about immigrants or black people being in white towns. Like he steals their women, like he literally fucks a guy's wife and like is running around causing trouble. It's like, this is what he's warning against and he's doing. Like, and he's just such a hypocrite.
He's a full puppeteer. Like, hypocrite is exactly it. It's just that thing where you're like, you can't see and no one around you can see that, like, when you do it on your body, it just looks like a white person existing.
I think it's also that he's a northerner. Like, his accent stands out from everybody else. And so going into the, that's why going into the film, I thought like, oh, he's actually going to be one of the good guys. Yeah. And he's going to sabotage him. And it's like, no, that's my bias thinking that someone who seems urbane, someone from Washington, like could not come in here and be this bad seed that like just lights up a whole town.
Yeah. But it's just the power of like that, like charismatic front on energy that says, I have an answer for you. And it's actually just steeped in like the power of someone who's only out for themselves. Like, and just to watch the mechanics of obviously a big film for being like to have watched this at the time it came out, it would have felt super like radical in the sense that like there are specific, like the way that you engineer hate, like the way that you plan a tactic of hate is something that to like see as calculated and like scheduled and thought out as it is in this film is like literally informative. There's a bit where he's like essentially trying to notch up a level of hate in the town, and he instructs a young girl to like what to do at school the next day and to essentially be like
make a false accusation against one of the black students,
rape accusation against one of the black students, and like tells her how to do it. And then you see him, the William Shatner character, hear the news in town and be like, all right, we got to go down to the school. And just like, yeah, the actual mechanics of what that looks like is super important to see, you know?
And that he's with this young girl as well. Like,
he's sleeping with her. He's like,
it's like he's doing the thing.
The very first thing he says to her essentially is like, have you ever like dated someone old? You ever thought about dating an older guy or something like that? Like, He is doing all of the things that he's claiming he's doing to them.
Can I ask, what did you think of the movie's denouement? How, so this is like, that's him making this false story about one of the black students.
Yeah.
Sort of builds into a big climax. They're about to lynch this kid outside school. They sort of just put him on a playground set and like he's just standing on the swing set and is pushed back and forth.
I think the implication is like, it's about to mount to them burning him.
That tension was funny to me there for a minute. Like, I know it's not meant to be funny at all.
That it didn't have a threat to it.
Yeah, I thought, is this sort of meant to be like a strange misdirect that it's like, oh, they're just going to bully him while he's on this swing. But
oh, I thought it was cut well to like, it cuts to the kids and it just showed that like crucial step of like dehumanization as like an extreme facet of what it is to make people feel valid in hating someone. Like what it is to be like, if you can laugh at another person with a group of people, that now feels like community and that now feels like culture. Yeah. And then now that's just how your brain works. Like it just kind of illustrates the mechanics of things that feel so like, how does your brain work that way? And it really shows them to you. Whilst
I guess the opposite happens. Feel like they were extra pathetic that they just put him on a swing set for a minute and were pushing back and forth. Like there was something really humiliating and strange about it to me.
Yeah, like you didn't know if it was going to mount or not.
No, I mean you could tell it was going to.
Yeah.
You know. But then one of the people that Adam has wronged, that William Shatner's character has screwed over, finds this girl that lied and drags her out and explains this was all a scheme. And I was really surprised and probably didn't find it that realistic how the white townsfolk who are about to kill this accused kid reacted.
Oh, it felt a bit calculated.
It brings down the whole villain scheme. Everybody is like, oh, we were wrong. We almost hanged an innocent man. Let's quietly walk away. And they all abandon him while he's screaming at them to continue to follow him. I was like, I'm on Twitter. I'm on X. I know people do not abandon their ideals that quickly
it's clearly a story beat in service of the idea that I think is kind of the film's best, which is like some people say something authentically and no one registers it. And some people lie to your face and it sounds so full of truth or something. Like just having him be preaching the same things he did previously with this, just
it makes
like,
them realize it was all a lie.
Like everything just sounds ridiculous. And as it sounds ridiculous, you feel like I've literally been a sheep. Like I know what it was in service of, but I do agree that it's pretty like,
I think it's
empty
too hard for people like this to massive admit. White mob. They wouldn't admit that quickly that they're wrong and move away.
Also, because the power of what's been happening up to that point is, again, the way that they write and critique William Shatner's character is both not too obvious and really perceptive for its time, in that there's this added detail that he is a hate mongerer who is trying to protect himself from, like, it doesn't show him as enjoying the violence. He's always being like he is critiqued by people being like, you are going to get someone killed. And he's being like, I've got a handle of this. Like, I'm stoking up the hate, but no one's going to die. And he brings them all to the school and he's like, but now, guys, we're not going to kill anyone. And you are watching him in the background.
Lose control.
Be like, oh, maybe this was a bad idea. They're maybe going to kill this kid. So the ending does kind of diffuse that. But then there's the thing of like, the only way to follow through on that idea is for this film to kill this young black man, which I also don't want to see. You know what I mean? Yeah. For it to follow through on that idea is like, well, then that would be the lynching happening.
Yeah.
And I think just as a person don't want to see that.
Sure. Something I would also like congratulate this movie for, maybe it was like sort of a, I don't know, Hays Code thing or some, but like compared to other movies and particularly like contemporary sort of Oscar winning movies we see these days about like racial hatred or bigotry or whatever, like it's not a really, really difficult to watch graphic violent movie.
No,
you hear the N-word a lot, which is like, I guess, a violence in itself, but it's quite like restrained and stark. And the black actors are not being warped within an inch of their lives all the time, like we typically expect to see now films about blackness in the US.
It still is a case of like films like this where the events being portrayed so literally, like we probably don't need anymore because they've been told so much.
Mm.
But for a film of its era, yes, it doesn't. It doesn't exercise the very like visible, literal acts of violence.
There's crosses burning. There's like cars of like families and they're getting like harassed and scared and stuff.
Yeah, but there's, not like lynching necessarily. Yeah. Which
it's
again,
not really
is,
a horror movie. It's drama.
It's a drama. It's not even a horror film at all, no. Which is what I think leads to the choice they make at the end to not have him be lynched and have the town sort of come to that awareness. I agree that I think the film's strength is its critique of William Shatner's character as just all gloss and gleam on the surface. My favorite scene of the film is, well, obviously every scene in this film is depressing as hell, but it's so well written. It's just like so at this hotel he's staying at, the neighbor and his wife, the neighbor himself is away for a few days, and William Shatner is always trying to get with her.
Interesting character.
And
she
it's this idea
not
that
from the South as well. And she's sort of onto him a bit more. She's the only person that sort of sees through him a bit.
She sees through his bullshit, and that idea of like trusting someone's eyes more than the shit coming out of their mouth. She's always refusing him at the door. He shoves his way in, and you just see the whole thing with this character being like everything he says, you're like, how could the double standard of your life being that you justify every single act through being like, well, I'm morally a man of God, so I couldn't do evil.
Mm.
Whilst you are doing all the things that you're trying to get young black kids lynched for. And it's essentially just him, the very inch by inch pushing the line that leads to rape and sexual assault. Like the mechanics of how it happens is so like, well, just let me in. Well, just offer me a drink. Well, it would be rude of you to not. And then like, you hear how someone couldn't hear the word no. Like you can hear how to him, he's like, why are you saying that to me? And you're like, what other option is available to this person? It's just, it was really scary. And then later on, he's confronted by her husband, the neighbor.
Who's the one that exposes him. And he calls her like a Jew or something, right? Or he's...
Oh, he says something. And he says something to her. No, so the neighbor says something to William Shatner where he's like, William Shatner gets his gun and he's like, I know you're not going to shoot me because you're weak. You're not. You don't have any conviction in you. Like I knew that from the first second I saw you. And it's just that brutal moment of, as we love in films, we talked about it with Challengers a lot the other week, just like people of, you know, people that spew a lot of shit from their mouth but have no substance, and then people who are just like doers and people of action. And that idea of a person of action being like, you are entirely full of shit. Kill me then.
You know
shoot
what?
Me. And him just standing there with the gun and like literally looking like a scared little boy and being like, get out of here. When he doesn't shoot the gun, he's like, go away. Like, get out of here. Leave. And you're like, yeah, you have no substance. Like, you're barely a person.
I reckon I would love to move on to comparing both movies because they're sort of coming together as a real solid double feature for me now.
For real. Let's do it. I'm keen to hear it.
it is fascinating to me, the point you're making, Noah, about the villain of The Intruder, William Shatner's character, being someone who, like, his main crimes are obviously being horrifically bigoted, but his character flaw below that is inaction, weak, doesn't do what he's saying. He doesn't actually have any values. And that's similar to Bucket of Blood, a hero in that case, where it's like, he's kind of the opposite. He's a real doer. He will do the thing and like put himself in the line, but he doesn't have the
conscience to stop
and reflect. Artistic spirit to back him up or any motivation or anything. Yeah. So it's interesting that early on in Corman's career, where he would have been working so hard to get the meager budget he had for these movies, he really values and romanticizes people that do perhaps more than talking or thinking too
totally
much.
And what it is that, like, a career, like, how many very, very prolific filmmakers are regarded also as like mentors or leaders? Like, this idea of like what it is to influence people is, yeah, I think
he's
to,
an
be,
influencer. Wow.
To be a true influencer, to be someone of action. Yeah. The idea that, like, there are a lot of people who will try to talk themselves out of a hole or talk up the idea of what they could or couldn't be. But yeah, that I think it's such an astute observation of its time to say, we know, like, reading some of the reviews for The Intruder, actually, I do think it was very obviously very timely and probably hadn't been put on film enough. But the reviews are like a lot of people saying, like, this, we are all familiar with the wrongs and evils of this time. Why do you need to tell it so literally? I think there is a critique in that, but I would say, like, the film's most unique perspective is to say the way to encapsulate the contradiction, the hypocrisy, the evil and, like, bigotry of this very American and very Western
time and space
is a character that is charismatic and all bullshit under the hood. Like, to be like,
someone you want to see in a movie, unfortunately.
Yeah, like, I can reflect this entire way of being by focusing on these types. And we all know those types now, you know what I mean? Like, just someone that the very nature of what gives them the engine to take up so much space, to demand so much attention, is that they are trying to convince themselves that they are someone because they know that they're not. Like, it's actually like, it looks, you know, the classic thing with
it's honest because it captures like a kind of person that's still around you feel.
Yeah, I just think that classic thing with confidence, like, you look at someone loud and you're like, wow, they must love themselves. And you're like, they are desperate for someone else to love them because they can't love themselves. Yeah. Like, that is The Intruder. That is him being like, I know I'm a piece of shit, but the more people that rally behind me, the more I can, like,
the flex,
kick that can
others
down the road and deal with it on my deathbed, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved them.
So we both loved and noted the pragmatism that is in both of these movies. Going forward, we're going to watch 4 more Corman movies. Are you worried that these movies are not going to be particularly deep? Like, Bucket of Blood and The Intruder, we really liked. There's so much on the surface level to enjoy. You're saying critics found them maybe a bit literal. Are you, like, nervous that the next 4 movies are just going to blend together in a massive, like,
I think I'd anticipated more of that, honestly. Yeah. Like, these two were really...
Not to say they have no substance. It's just presented in a very direct way.
I think be prepared that what we're going to be touching on now is back to more, like, you are watching, like, a charming, well-made, effective little horror film is what's going to kind of come forward. Like, of the 6 films we picked the best of the bunch, and both from what he's produced and directed. When you say Corman, I think of, like, Attack of the Crab Monsters, like, things like that, you know? So
I feel like he also, it's real, and we like these. I thought these were both really good movies.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have any movies where people could say this is one of the best movies of all time. Like, it comes to trashy kind of genre things, there are directors who have more individuality.
Yeah,
maybe take more risks.
It's also easy to, like, forget that he was the only one doing this for a long time. Like, it feels like horror and genre stuff, like, that's always been around. But, like, really...
Making this your whole wheelhouse.
Yeah, I listened to a really interesting interview with him on the Blockbusters podcast a little bit ago. And he speaks about how the summer of Jaws and Star Wars was obviously like, you know, a gunshot to the whole industry. Like it changed everything. But particularly for him, he's like, the only people making films with the story of Jaws and Star Wars was me. I made sci-fi films and I made monster movies.
Crazy high concept.
I made like a woman swimming in a lake and then a, you know, a water monster comes and grabs her. So that was really like, they are now making the stories that I used to make with budgets that I, you know, my financial model is built on getting them done cheap. And he had just started his new production company. And this is when the output, I believe, like his output decreased and the films all became more like mid-tier budget as opposed to like completely like really cheap budget. So like Battle Beyond the Stars marks the point where he's like, if I want to keep making, you know, like he had.
I need to, like, it's a Star Wars ripoff. And so it's like, he's like, I kind of need a bit more of Star Wars budget too.
Yeah, yeah. And like he'd made his version of Star Wars like 1,000 times, but because it's not made at the level of Star Wars, it didn't register the same way, of course. He would always make money back. That's what he did. But it is that thing where, yeah, his economic model kind of now did need to go a bit more mid-tier, which is kind of tragic. Is that where
the next two movies are as well? Next week we're
talking about
the man with the x-ray eyes.
I think everything we're doing is pre the sort of new Hollywood shift. So we're doing all these things once he's sort of like in his prime of directing up until, the summer blockbuster becomes the mainstream, really.
And it busted his block too.
Busted his block as well. So next week we are doing two more incredible classics
from
the absolute king. We are doing one of his eight Edgar Allan Poe adaptations. We're doing The Brilliant, The Mask of the Red Death. And we are also doing
X. Man with the X-ray eyes. So spooky time.
Spooky time. Firmly goofy creature visual effects feast things to come, which are going to be really great. Thank you so much for listening, friends. That episode next week will be for Patreon listeners only. So if you're not one, you should hop on over to Patreon. You can listen to it there. You can also vote on the poll for our next iteration of the Slot Bucket. Follow us on Insta, Facebook, Letterboxd.
Yep.
And get in touch with us if there's a Roger Corman film that we aren't talking about that we should, or we should do in the future. Or
when I see a Corman film, I say, Corman.
Corman.
What a crazy film.
There's like a Coors joke in there, I think.
The Coors, man.
Oh, the band. There's also a beverage, right?
Coors.
A beer.
Yeah, Coors. Yeah, true.
Yeah, no, you're right. The Coors is the better one. What do they sing?
Da 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 da.
I love that song where it goes that's so good.
Yeah, so good.
Little, what's that called? Augmented?
Bend?
So usually it goes and at the very end of the song it goes what would that be?
Are you
that's okay, Magic Mama?
I feel like what you're describing sounds like Tiesta Piketty, which is when you have it's like a
Tiesta Piketty
Western classical music term for when no one could ever have the guts hundreds of years ago to end a piece of music on a minor chord. So even a piece of music that is 99% in a minor key, it ends on a major chord. So that's what a Tiesta Piketty is. And it sounds like
you're Tiesta Piketty.
Yeah. T-I-E-R-S, new word.
Tia.
D-E, new word.
Da.
Piketty. I'll show you it later.
One episode.
Is it that?
In the next year, I want you to make up a concept and we will guess at the end of the year which one it was.
Who's to say I haven't already started?
Yeah, you've been playing that every day and we just never fact check.
Tiesta Piketty is just. You wouldn't have come up
That's
with that.
That's super specific. Wait, so Tiesta Piketty is when they want, when they did do it on a minor finish?
Back in the day. And when I say back in the day, I mean like 400 or 500 years ago.
Yeah.
You basically couldn't end a piece of music on a minor chord.
Or else you go to hell.
So you either start in a major key and end on a major chord, or you start in a minor key and still end on a major chord.
Okay, nice.
That's the go. So Tiesto Piccadilly is when it ends on a major chord when it was in a minor key.
It does make me feel comfortable.
You know there was a chord that the Catholic Church banned, the Devil's Chord?
Is it the James Bond chord?
Well, I don't know. I don't know about it being Devil's like a specific chord. Yeah, the tritone is an interval of like two notes, which is referred to as like the Devil's interval for a long time. So it's like... it's six semitones apart. It's like it's just below a perfect fifth. That was banned.
That's really profound.
It sounds evil.
That evil is so close to perfection, you know?
Yes.
Wow.
That's the balance right there.
Especially when the dominant powers get to decide what perfection is.
Whoa. Wow. Putting the whole system on trial. Let's all try and harmonize. One, two, three.
Wait, we
did the same note.
We ended up doing the same note, and Anthony were like blooping and bleeping.
Yeah,
the bloops and bleeps can still harmonize with us. One, two, three.
Okay.
Try again next week.
Bye.
Bye.